Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman in for Chris Boyd. In the hours following this weekend's mass shooting in Orlando, people across the country headed to their local blood banks to make a donation. In Florida, more than 5,000 people reportedly donated blood through a statewide network on Sunday, which was a single-day record. And this isn't the first time people have lined up to give blood after an attack. It happened after September 11th. It happened in Boston after the marathon bombing. It's a way for people to show their support and to try and help people who've been injured in some way. And it does help, but the process is more complicated than that. There's no direct line from the arm of the donor to the patient in the hospital. And here to talk about the complex business of our blood supply are two experts, local experts, Dr. Ravi Sarode, he's Director of Transfusion Medicine at UT Southwestern, and Dr. William Cruz, Medical Director of Laboratory Services for Carter Blood Care. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So let's start with clarifying and debunking one headline that I kept seeing going around in the past day or two. And it read, gay men outraged over continued ban on blood donation. Is there really a ban on blood donation for gay men?
Well, there's currently that took place recently as last month, May 23rd. The FDA regulations were changed. There was a lifetime ban for gay males who wanted to be blood donors. But as of May 23rd, that was relaxed to a 12-month deferral for men who've had sex with other men. Now, at Carter Blood Care, we're in the process of implementing that policy, and we expect to have it in place within another month or two. So there's no out-and-out ban except for if you're gay and you haven't had male-to-male sexual contact for 12 months, then you are eligible to be a blood donor.
And that change, though, it was pretty, like you said, it was recent. It's something that the restrictions go back, I think, to the 80s after the HIV and the AIDS epidemic.
Yeah, back in the 80s, you know, there were a lot of highly publicized cases of blood recipients contracting HIV from blood transfusion. And so the FDA implemented a strict policy to ensure that the blood supply was as safe as possible. And so they had that. The old regulation was even if a man had had sexual contact just once since 1977, then they were indefinitely deferred. But after like a subcommittee of experts met and discussed the research and data that was available, and they felt that it could safely be relaxed to a 12-month deferral period instead of an indefinite deferral period.
And, yeah, go ahead, Dr. Sarode.
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in a little bit. I think the history started in 1984, 85, and we realized that HIV was transmitted by, you know, sexual contact, blood transfusion. And there was a lot of public phobia at that time. And I still remember being in India and people were talking about can I use a toilet seat, someone who had used it. So you can imagine the fear about HIV was so strong amongst the general public that FDA had to come up with some very strong guidelines so that public felt safe. And I think over a period of time, we have developed several testing efforts which are in place, and we know that now blood is very safe because we are able to detect infection very early by day 7.
That's correct. the current testing that's performed on blood donations involves a molecular detection of the actual virus in the blood, whereas, you know, 15, 20 years ago, we were detecting an antibody, and that would take longer for someone who was what's known as a window period to make those antibodies that could be detected. But now, as Dr. Sarode mentioned, the window period is shortened down to around 7 days. And so as soon as 7 days, if someone is carrying the HIV virus, it can be detected in the current testing.
And is that testing something that's expensive to do? Is it or is it just one of many tests that gets done and it's not a big deal?
Well, all testing does add a cost onto the production of available blood units. And as you mentioned, it's one of many tests that is performed. We also test for hepatitis B, hepatitis C, Chagas, West Nile, syphilis. And I'm probably forgetting a few, but there's a whole battery of tests that we perform to ensure that the blood supply is as safe as possible.
And I think, you know, that's why based on this scientific evidence that the testing is so robust that we are able to detect earliest transmission of HIV. I was actually on the committee which reports to the DHHS health secretary. It's called Advisory Committee on Blood Safety and Availability. And we had discussed it at length for over 4 or 5 years. And the government had spent some money to do the research. And based on that, I think we felt comfortable that we could go step by step, and instead of lifting ban completely, we now reduce it to 1 year and collect data going forward and to see if we can make it even more liberal.
Of course, a lot of people are, and it's come out in the past few days as after the shooting in Orlando, are very frustrated and are calling out the seeming hypocrisy of the ban. For it sounds like if a woman who's heterosexual has had sex with however many partners, protected or unprotected, she may be allowed to donate, but a man who in the past year has had sex with another man would not be able to.
I mean, that's the current rules.
And so with the tests that are done today, though, you're saying that perhaps the ban is no longer, even a year is more than enough to have.
Right. So I think, as I said, you know, we are going step by step. So mm-hmm. we need to understand that we don't want to be seen as discriminatory or something, but we also have to understand the feelings and history of HIV, which has devastated a lot of patients who received blood which was tainted. So I think we have to balance it, and there's always a balance. And I think we have to just stay calm and make sure that, you know, we take one step at a time and make our blood safe.
Let's talk a little bit about logistics. This is sort of a hidden industry of blood that is really fascinating. And what happens when thousands of people donate blood in a day, like what happened to Orlando? What happens with that blood, Dr. Cruz?
So just to give an overview of the process of what happens for a blood donation. So a blood donor walks into a blood center, a fixed site center, or either a mobile blood drive where we have our staff set up at businesses or schools or churches or any building in the community. And so they have to read donor education material, sign a consent. We perform what's known as a mini physical, where we check their blood pressure, check their pulse. We also check their hemoglobin mm-hmm. level to make sure that their blood levels at an adequate level for the blood donation to take place. And then from there, after the collection, it's brought back to our blood center facility, and it's processed. And so
to a central facility.
Yeah, to a centralized uh-huh. facility. And from there, we can separate the whole blood donation into red cells, into plasma, into platelets, and also another product known as cryoprecipitate. And we also perform the testing that we've talked about previously. And then from there, after the testing comes back, everything checks out. The blood is labeled, and then we ship it out to the hospitals to be used for patient use.
How long does that take?
So it can take up to 2 days. Mm-hmm. It just depends on the timing of the testing and the processing of all the products. So at a minimum, 24 hours, but it can take up to 48 hours for that product to be available for use in hospitals.
And why is it important to separate out the different parts of the blood, Dr. Sirode? Why are there even different parts of blood? What does that mean?
You know, so in the past, we used the whole blood. So we took out blood from one person and transfused to another one. And usually it was for anemia, so they had low hemoglobin. But then we realized that, you know, everybody who has anemia doesn't need other blood components like platelets or plasma. whereas there are patients who need selectively platelets or plasma. So I think for last, almost 3-4 decades, we have been separating whole blood into different components. Sure. The advantage is that one particular donor can help now 3 or 4 different patients. And that's the reason we use blood component therapy rather than whole blood, which is sparingly used.
So what are the different components? Just briefly, what are platelets specifically for and so on, and plasma?
So red cells, which make blood look red, they have very important function of carrying oxygen to different tissues. And without red cells, we can't breathe and live. And whereas platelets, they are, and plasma, they are important components of blood, which helps in preventing you from bleeding out. Mm. So if you don't have enough platelets, you will see that you have frequent nosebleeds. You can have petechia, small bleeding blotches on your skin.
And so it helps with clotting.
Right. So basically both platelets and plasma, they help clotting. So if you have cuts or bruises or you have trauma, that's where these components, they come into play. And in a given patient, for example, a patient who's on bone marrow transplant ward, who's getting bone marrow transplant, they have very low platelets and they are at risk for bleeding. And these are the patients who require more frequent platelet transfusion. So we can selectively use these components. Similarly, for patients who have liver disease or they have even massive trauma, so you can't just give them red cells. So they need, at the same time, plasma. So we can mix and match these components in different proportions and transfuse them in a trauma situation. Whereas a non-trauma situation, it's very easy to tailor the treatment accordingly.
So for someone who's, I'm thinking of some of the victims who are still in the hospital in Orlando, what kind of transfusions might they be in need of, or does it just depend on the individual if it's after gunshot?
So after gunshot, generally, I mean, we see in Parkland Hospital quite often or motor vehicle accidents. So they have major tissue trauma. And these patients, they bleed profusely from a variety of wounds. And when they come to the hospital, they need not just the red cells, but they will also need at a later time platelets and plasma. So we have protocols in place where we can proportionally dispense these rapidly within minutes. But, if you have one trauma, it's easy. But if you have 50 patients coming at one time, then it becomes really logistically challenging. And it becomes, as we heard on TV and I saw on TV, trauma surgeons talking about their challenges. And therefore, I think when you have trauma and this kind of situation, it's going to be very tricky.
To coordinate all the amount you might need. I imagine that stockpile isn't that large at a hospital. I mean, I'm sure it's good, but is it for 50 people?
I mean, 50 people who need 10 units of blood each patient, I think that's when we immediately call Carter Blood Care, and because they have larger. So they are like a bank, and, blood banks are like a wallet.
You need a loan, yeah.
Yeah, so we hopefully, we generally get quick delivery of blood.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman in for Chris Boyd. And we're talking this hour about blood donations during disasters and what happens here in North Texas in such a situation. We're talking with Dr. Ravi Sarode. He's Director of Transfusion Medicine at UT Southwestern. And Dr. William Cruz, who's Medical Director of Laboratory Services for Carter Blood Care. You can join the conversation, call with questions. The number is 800-933-5372. You can always email think@kera.org, or you can reach us on Twitter @KERAThink. And coming up, we'll talk about how technology is connecting blood donations across cities and states.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program, where students can customize their degree, like Lonnie Gentry, pursuing healthcare leadership and ethics. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman in for Chris Boyd. After natural disasters, earthquakes or storms, and acts of terror like the shooting in Orlando this weekend, many Americans try and help survivors by donating blood. It's our way of showing support, of connecting on many different levels. But there's a shelf life to blood, and sometimes what's donated might not end up where we think. So here to talk about what happens with blood donations are two experts. Dr. William Cruz is Medical Director of Laboratory Services for Carter Blood Care, and Dr. Ravi Sarode is Director of Transfusion Medicine at UT Southwestern. Dr. Cruz, what is the shelf life of blood?
So for red cells, the shelf life is typically 42 days. And for platelets, it's even shorter than that. It's 5 days. And by the time the testing is done and it's practically in the hospital, it can be as little as a three-day shelf life for platelets. And for the other component, plasma, that we've talked about, that's a frozen product. It can be frozen for up to a year.
Okay. And
I think the different shelf lives, it has to do with the storage of these blood components. So red cells, they are stored at, you know, refrigerated temperature between 1 and 6 degrees Celsius. Whereas platelets, they don't survive in cold. So they have to be stored at room temperature. And since they are at room temperature, there is increased chances of bacterial growth. And that's the reason we don't keep platelets longer than 5 days. And therefore, platelets, they're always in short supply. And I would encourage your listeners to come and donate platelets more often than red cells, because platelets are always in short supply. And you have patients with cancer and transplantation, trauma. They usually need more platelets.
Can you choose as a donor whether what you want to donate, and how does that change the process, if at all, of donating?
Yes, and so, like, if someone who may be listening, if they are a regular blood donor, they can walk in and say, today I want to try donating platelets. Now, just to inform the listening audience, donating platelets does take longer based on the machine that is the donor is connected to a machine that just takes out the platelets and returns every other component back to the donor. And so it does take a little bit longer.
How long are you talking about?
I would say probably an hour and a half.
Okay.
From the time you walk into the donor for the donor center to when you walk out. But as Dr. Sarode mentioned, those products are in a much higher demand and have a higher likelihood of actually helping out and
saving lives,
in the community.
Perhaps.
Yes.
That's interesting. I had no idea that. So you can't freeze them is the problem.
No.
You can't refrigerate them. They die?
Yeah, not yet.
Yes.
I mean, there are people who are doing research trying to freeze these platelets or store in cold, but not yet. And the problem is, you know, for example, in my blood bank right now, I may have 200 units of red cells, but only 10 units of platelets. So you can imagine the difference amount.
Yes.
Let's go to the phones now. And you can call anyone at 1-800-933-5372 with questions. That's where we're going to find Suzanne, and calling from Fort Worth. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello. I'm a longtime medical technologist in transfusion services, working for Red Cross, Cook Children's, and Harris here in Fort Worth. And perhaps it's a little early in the show, but I've never experienced what the people in the blood bank in Orlando must have experienced. But the first thing that happens is, of course, the hospital declares some sort of trauma, some sort of alert, and gets people in. But the other thing that we do in the blood bank is we get on the phone to our blood supplier and tell them, send me everything you've got, O neg, O pos, all the AB plasma, platelets. And those blood centers then will draw from existing hospitals once everybody realizes that this is a real trauma. Those blood centers will also start to import from other blood centers within, in our case, Texas, Oklahoma, wherever, and get blood in, because that's going to be the first and most ready choice of products. And perhaps I'm a little early in the show, but these folks can address this.
Yeah.
And God help me, I'm glad I never had to experience Orlando. I've experienced some pretty horrific situations. But thank you for having this discussion.
Thanks, Suzanne. So, yeah, how is coordination work, Dr. Cruz?
Sure. So there's actually a saying in the blood center community that the blood on the shelf is what saves lives. And so for the horrific situation in Orlando, I believe in addition to the 49 casualties, there were like over 50 people who were injured. And so those people are going to need blood right away. They're not going to be able to wait. As I mentioned, it can take up to 48 hours for a blood donation to become available. So they're going to need blood right away. And as the caller mentioned, the hospitals are going to need, and the blood center as well, are going to need to replenish the supply that they had to emergently issue out to the local hospitals. And so at Carter Blood Care, we're part of two organizations, Blood Centers of America, and as well as AABB, American Association of Blood Banks. Hmm. And so these organizations, they have teams who can coordinate communication in disasters. And so for the incident in Orlando, they reached out to the blood centers down there saying, do you guys need products? And if you do, what products do you need? And that information gets disseminated to the other member blood centers across the nation. And so then
it's
a
call out.
Right. And so that, and of course, you know, that can take up to a day to replenish the supply that they had to emergently issue out on, I guess it was early Sunday morning.
Now, last year I did some reporting for KERA on the cost of blood and spoke with a Dallas entrepreneur who's trying to help hospitals coordinate and lower the cost of bringing in blood. He told me that the idea for this is called Blood Buy, came during the ice storm in 2011. Let's listen.
There was a local news story on that evening about how the ice storm had hindered the ability to collect blood because they couldn't mobilize the blood mobiles and people couldn't drive into the brick-and-mortar locations.
The blood shortage caught Chris Godfrey's attention, and he got curious about blood as a commodity. What'd he learn? It's hard for hospitals to maintain an adequate supply of the red gold.
You know, it's not like if you run out of milk, you're fine. We'll just go without milk. But if you run out with blood, you know, there are lives at risk. So the stakes are very high.
Managing a blood supply is not like managing morphine or pain pills. Blood products can expire fast, within days, and supplies vary by region. Blood donations in Des Moines might be high, whereas in Houston, there may be a shortage. The problem, Godfrey says, is most hospitals rely on an inefficient system anchored by regional blood centers, meaning blood, well, it isn't flowing freely across the country. That's why Godfrey started Blood Buy. It's a sort of price line for blood products, connecting supply with demand in a multi-billion dollar industry.
You have blood centers on the supply side and hospitals on the demand side. So we act as kind of a technology backbone that sits in between them and connects everybody.
Like Priceline, Blood Buy uses a series of matching algorithms to pair what a hospital is willing to pay with what's available. So far, there are users in Texas, Tennessee, Louisiana, Florida, and Massachusetts.
Because it's such a rare commodity and you're asking people to donate their precious blood, you don't want to waste any of it.
Mike Dossie is with John Peter Smith Health Network in Fort Worth. Blood, he says, comes at a price.
We spend just under $4 million a year on blood products.
JPS doesn't use Blood Buy, but Dossie sees how such a service could save money by making prices more transparent across the country. Today, a hospital pays anywhere from $170 to $300 for a pint of blood. In a pilot program, Blood Buy's technology saved Texas Medical Center in Houston more than 20% on blood expenditures. Still, JPS's Dossie says there are risks to using a price line for blood. He wouldn't want to rely on a blood supply that's not local. A good relationship with the blood bank in town is crucial, he says, when there's unexpected trauma.
You could have, a 10-car pileup out on the interstate and need those products swiftly, and having that relationship with our vendor is also key to getting those products here when you need them.
Dr. Cruz, you're with Carter Blood Bank, and I understand it serves more than 50 counties, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Who coordinates, and is there a whole team coordinating between the blood bank and the hospitals in the area 24/7? I'm imagining like a command center.
Well, yeah, we have a distribution department that has the capability to, like you mentioned, 24 hours a day. A hospital can call in, or we have a web-based system too where they can place orders for mm-hmm. the products that they need. And then we have vans that actually distribute the blood out to the hospitals as they place their request.
Is there a challenge, and in that piece that we just heard, is there a need for better technology for coordinating blood, for getting it between states, and I know we all come from different backgrounds, so perhaps there are different biases here, but what do you think?
Well, I know at Carter, our focus is to ensure that the blood that we collect stays in the community that we collect from. So our first mission is to ensure that the blood stays in the 50 counties that we serve. And if it not, then we at least try to make sure it stays within Texas, the state of Texas.
Okay.
So that's not really a focus of ours, to collect blood and then ship it out to other regions of the country.
What do you think, Dr. Cerruti?
Yeah, I think, I must say that Carter Blood Care has done a phenomenal job in this region, because I've been at UT Southwestern for the last 15 years, and I don't remember having any shortages. We may have shortages during long Christmas holidays and, 4th of July. And I think that's when we should encourage most of the donors to go and donate. But we never had acute shortages where we had to rely on getting blood from outside Carter Blood Care. And we are also thankful to their approach in the community, that they want to keep blood within the community where you collect. For example, if I donate blood, I feel nice if it stays in the community.
In Texas, are we equipped to mobilize mass blood drives?
Yes. As far as the situation like Orlando, now I will say that each blood center's set up to process a maximum number of donors a day. Like, so at Carter, our goal is typically to collect around 1,000 donors per day. So if you get an overabundance of donors who want to come out and help after a tragedy, it can overwhelm the processes of the blood center.
Is there a plan for that? Do you guys have an emergency plan?
Yeah, so what we typically do is if we know we're going to be reaching capacity, then we will ask donors to make a pledge to come back at a later time to donate, maybe in another 3 days, another mm-hmm. week, another couple of weeks. Because as I mentioned, there's always a need for blood, and it's the blood on the shelf that's going to save lives. And you can never predict, a tragedy. And so once we know we're going to breach capacity, because we don't want anyone standing in line for hours and hours and hours, and, our staff is working as hard as they can. So we want everyone to have a pleasant experience when they donate. So
as pleasant as
possible. And so if we would ask people to come back at a later time to donate.
Which is what they've done in Orlando as well. And like you said, it sounds extremely important that people don't just donate as the news is, while something's on the news, but in the weeks to come.
And the hope is that if anybody's a first-time donor, like in Orlando, that they would become a regular donor, as a result of this.
Now, in terms of too much, is there ever too much donated? And what happens to blood that doesn't get used?
There can be times where you have an overabundance of blood. And
since it has a short, some of it has a short shelf life.
And in those situations, we may look to other blood centers to see if they have a need for the blood. If all our hospitals are well-stocked and well-supplied, then we will look to see if we can move that blood to other centers that have a need for it.
But Dr. Cerruti, do you have to ever dispose of how often blood products? Is that just common part of the business?
Yeah, but the way we manage our inventory in the blood banks and even at the Carter Blood Care, I think we're very cognizant of wasting any blood products. And therefore, I think the amount of blood we waste is very minimal. And we try to use judiciously. We try to collect appropriately so that we don't have abundance and then waste it. So I think because it's coming from a donor, it's a precious.
It's part of you.
Yeah. It's not like, I have every now and then conversation with some of my colleagues who want, I need my blood now, I need platelets now. And, unfortunately, they don't grow on trees, this blood is coming from a donor, and we have to respect that. So we are very careful about how we use blood.
And we do have policies in place to help manage the blood supply. So if it's at a facility that doesn't transfuse as much as the UT Southwest system, then we will take that blood back if it's short dated. Let's say if it was a unit of O negative blood that was going to expire in 7 days, then we would ask them to send that blood back to us, and we would send it to a larger healthcare system that performs more transfusions.
Where it might be able to be used a little bit.
Yeah, before it expires.
Yeah, before it goes bad. All right. Well, I'm going to ask you coming up about O negative and some of the different types of blood. And we spoke about how platelets are in high demand.
Right. But
we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. And I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Ravi Sarode, Director of Transfusion Medicine at UT Southwestern, and Dr. William Cruz. He's Medical Director of Laboratory Services for Carter Blood Care. You can call in with questions. We'll get to phones. The number is 800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send a tweet to @KERA Think. In a minute, let's talk about synthetic blood. Why don't we have it? Coming up.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can customize your master's degree to distinguish yourself in the workplace. You can apply now for fall. Deadline is July 1st. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're talking about donating blood after disasters like the shooting in Orlando this weekend. Oftentimes, there's an outpouring of donations, a spike, and then blood supply just dries up. I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Ravi Sarode. He's Director of Transfusion Medicine at UT Southwestern, and by Dr. William Cruz, who's Medical Director of Laboratory Services for Carter Blood Care. And I promised before the break we'd talk about synthetic blood. So, Dr. Sarode, why don't we have synthetic blood?
That's a good question. So, I need to tell you this. So when I came to this country in 1992 to do my fellowship in transfusion medicine at the Blood Center of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and when I was starting my fellowship, that's when they were also talking about synthetic blood. And, jokingly, they said, why you want to do fellowship in transfusion medicine?
You'll be out of
You're out of job soon. And I think it's almost 25 years, and I still have a job. And I'm still training a lot of fellows here. So I think synthetic blood sounds good, that you can... But blood is very complex, especially red cells. And to use synthetic blood to deliver tissue oxygen by having chemicals and which is free in some solution, it has not materialized. They tried all kind of different methods. They had free hemoglobin. They had hemoglobin into some lipid capsules. And they cause a lot of toxicity. So they could carry oxygen for a very short period of time. But then they realized they had a lot of issues with testing. So they couldn't do other testing for chemistry or complete blood count. So you were getting all these results which were not reliable. So, yeah, I think it sounds very exciting to have synthetic blood that can take oxygen from your lungs and deliver to tissues. But I think that is only transient. There's only one blood product that might be licensed in South Africa for only a short period of time to use for emergency. So unfortunately, we don't have it. However, there are other techniques that have been used, and they are in development in different countries where they're using stem cells. So you have stem cells coming from the bone marrow, which are undifferentiated initially. And you stimulate them to go into different directions. So you can make them become red cells. You can stimulate to make them white cells and platelets. So right now, we have techniques to make platelets in the petri dish. So I'm hoping that in future, we should be able to get different blood components in the laboratory or in the factories making these each cell component.
If you want to call and join in on the conversation, you can reach us at 800-933-5372. That's where we'll go now. Let's talk with Tracy in Roanoke. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for asking.
Hi. My husband has a genetic condition called hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia, abbreviated to HHT, and he and other patients that have HHT often get blood transfusions. And by the way, the specialists for HHT in Dallas are at UT Southwestern, so we love UT Southwest. One thing I learned as a family member, with a family member that gets blood regularly, is that I didn't realize that people need to get Benadryl before they have their blood transfusion. Oftentimes my husband's blood level is pretty low, and really how low somebody's blood can be, and although he wouldn't feel good, still be alive. Because I know the hospital sometimes, if with a patient, they don't get blood unless they're sometimes below an 8, and I think 12 to 15 is the regular number. Also, like the clinic where the cancer patients and the other HHT patients and other patients who need regular blood transfusions, you know, the blood clinic has different protocols than, say, the hospital. Like, it can take it, he can get 2-3 units, like, during the day at the clinic, but if he goes to the hospital, it can take, like, 2 to 3 days, maybe, to get 3 or 4 units of blood. So, but I just was going to make a comment about that, because I've had to educate myself on sort of blood and how iron's made, and, I mean, excuse me, how blood and how iron is used to make blood, et cetera, et cetera. And anyway, I appreciate you having this discussion about blood today.
Thanks, Tracy. So, what is the process for the people receiving blood? Is there much preparation involved in getting it ready to and getting them ready for that, Dr. Sirode?
Right. I mean, to transfuse blood, it's a complicated process. First, you need to know the patient's blood type. Because we know that different types of main blood groups.
Yeah.
It's called blood type A, B, AB, and O. So A person has A antigen on their red cells, B has B antigen, AB has both A and B antigen, whereas O has none. So, and that's the reason O donors, they are considered universal donor, especially if you are O negative, meaning you do not have a D antigen, which is very unique and seen in about 85% of general population. So 15%, they are negative for D antigen. And therefore, O negative is the most precious blood that anyone can donate. And we always encourage them to come and donate more often, because we can use that for anybody who doesn't have blood type or they have complicated antibody workup in the blood bank. So once we get a request for blood in the blood bank that this person needs transfusion, we need to know their ABO blood type. We need to know their D antigen. And then we do some testing in their plasma to see if they have made antibody against some of the other antigens which are present on red cells. So apart from A and B antigens, we have a variety of antigens which are still mind-boggling. So we have Rh blood group, then you have Kel and Defi. So they go on and on. So if someone who's getting transfused repeatedly, since your blood is different than another person who donated it, it's likely that you can make an antibody against that antigen that you don't have on your red cells. And that's the reason it becomes very difficult in patients who are chronically transfused, that you have been exposed to so many different donors that now you have antibodies. And therefore, to find a compatible blood, it becomes challenging in the blood bank. And especially if you have different ethnic background. So I really want to make this point because patients with sickle cell anemia who belong to African-American ancestry, they have different antigenic makeup on their red cells. And most of our donors, they are Caucasians. So you can imagine the discrepancy between the antigens. That results in patients with sickle cell anemia making alloantibodies or antibodies which are destroying these transfused red cells. Mm. So I think it's very critical that we have donors who are coming from different ethnic backgrounds.
And that relates to someone wrote in an email. Paul in North Branch had asked if there's time where it's essential for a patient to get blood from a close relative. And I imagine that could be helpful if you're looking for similar blood or maybe not.
Maybe not. I mean, I discourage actually getting blood from a close relative.
Really?
Because even though it seems very nice that you can get blood from your, you know, brother or sister or you know, someone who's first degree relative, it can cause a very serious complication called graft versus host disease. And that can be fatal. And once we know that you're getting blood from your close relative, we have to treat it differently. We have to irradiate it to kill the white cells, which are the culprit. Because these white cells coming from a donor can attack tissues in the patient and cause a serious disease called graft versus host disease. And that's almost 100% fatal.
Wow.
So I discourage getting blood from first degree relative. It's better to donate in the general pool. And, you know, blood supply in general is very safe. And I think it's very critical for patients who are getting blood to ask the right questions, make sure they're informed, and they ask questions regarding infection or the complications so that they are in, you know, they know what they are getting into.
Let's go back to the phones. A call from Plano. Is it Ijav?
Yes. This is Ijav Malik.
Hi. Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. I had two questions. One is there any preference in the donors in terms of their age group, young, middle age, or elderly? And secondly, has there been any research done on having blood from non-humans, for example, any specific animals? If you can comment on that, please.
Great. Thank you so much.
So I'll answer the question about the age. To be a
Dr.
blood...
Dr. Cruz, thank you.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm just telling people in case they're curious. You're with Carter Blood Bank.
Yeah. So to be a blood donor, you have to be at least 16 years old. And if you're going to be a 16-year-old donor, we do require parental consent. But 17 plus, you can donate without parental consent. And there is no upper age limit. Mm-hmm. So as long as a donor is feeling fine, well, and healthy, and they pass all of the mini physical and answer the questions in a proper manner, then they can be eligible to be a blood donor. And I'll let...
So as regards getting blood from non-humans, that's how actually blood transfusion practices started in 200, 300 years back in England and Europe. So they tried to use goat blood, bovine, or, you know, cow blood and dogs, nothing worked because their blood is different than ours. And therefore, you can transiently transfuse it and you may have some effect, but usually outcome was disaster. And after that, they started working on using human blood.
What about the stem cells of, I don't know, animals? Would that have any more potential?
No, if we have to use stem cell, we might as well use our own, you know, I mean, because the antigenic makeup will be different.
And are there generally shortages of specific types of blood besides, I know the O negative is the universal, that's the sort of most coveted of the blood products, but are there shortages of others?
Typically, as you said, O negative is always in short supply. And since the majority of blood donors are O positive, that's the blood type that's in in greatest supply. And it can still be used as a universal donor. It's particularly in a emergency situation where if it's a tragedy and you don't have any more O negative units, a lot of places are implementing the practice of transfusing patients with O positive units.
Let's take one more call here. Let's go to Scott in Irving. Hi, Scott.
Hey. Hey, God bless you all for your work. I have a quick question. I'm 57. I'm healthy as a horse. I want to give blood still for this Orlando thing. Is it too late, or are the Carter places mobbed, or what do you think?
Thanks for your question. Is it too late to give, and could that blood possibly end up in Orlando, Dr. Cruz?
Well, it's not too late to give. If he's more than welcome to come out to one of our fixed sites, or either if there's a mobile drive in his area to come out and donate. As far as his blood making it to Orlando, I believe that they are currently in good supply for, you know, majority of the products that they need. I'm sure they may still need some O negative blood, but I think right now they have enough outpouring of the people in Florida to that they may not need to import any more blood products out from another state.
Is it possible that blood given today in Dallas could end up in Orlando? Is that something that would happen?
Not for a routine donation.
Yeah.
If there was a patient in Florida or Orlando, as Dr. Cerruti mentioned a few minutes ago, patients who are frequently transfused can develop what's known as an antibody.
Mm-hmm.
And if they have an antibody to what's known as a high-frequency antigen, and you need a donor, you know, it's considered a rare donor who's negative for the corresponding antigen, then we can – a hospital in Florida could call us up and say, hey, do you have any of these units available? And then we can ship that unit directly to the blood center in Orlando.
So. Yeah, I think, you know, some of these rare donors who donate blood, we freeze those red cells.
Oh,
and
yes.
They are good for up to 10 years. And they are shipped all over the world.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, if you are healthy and you have rare blood type, you can donate and you can help.
And you can find out your blood type when you go in for a donation?
Yes, they can call back to get that information. We don't divulge that information right there during the donation. But if a donor is curious, they can. There's a way to contact us to get that information.
Great. Thank you both so much. Dr. William Cruz is Medical Director of Laboratory Services for Carter Blood Care, and Dr. Ravi Sarode is Director of Transfusion Medicine at UT Southwestern. I really appreciate both of you coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Yes.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. It's engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help on the phones today from Liz Myung. Our associate producer is Samantha Guzman, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact us anytime via email, think@kera.org. Thank you so much for tuning in, and have a great day.